July 2014 will be history in a matter of hours. Let's take a few minutes to review what happened in July here in Michigan. There was plenty. Joining me to review the month, the Michigan Public Radio Network Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Mark.
Jonathan Osting covers the state capitol for MLive. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Susan Demas of Inside Michigan Politics.
Hi.
Much of July was spent anticipating next Tuesday, I think. The midterm primary is 5 days away, and there's a number of races and topics that we could talk about. We won't have time for all of them, but let's start with what appears to be a confusing proposition. Proposal one, which includes a framework to restore revenue to local governments that would be taken away by removing the personal property tax. It seems to be a head-scratcher for an awful lot of people. Jonathan, can you explain the measure here for us?
Yeah, sure. You mentioned that the thing people are actually going to vote on is replacement revenue for local governments who would lose money if the personal property tax on small business equipment and on large industrial manufacturing equipment is phased out, which the legislature has already approved. So voters are deciding the fate of the PPT ultimately, but what they're really going to see on the ballot is this question of shifting some use tax dollars that the state currently collects to a local version that would then be used to repay local governments. So it is confusing. There's a ton of support for it. State government leaders, local government leaders, business groups, of course, who would benefit from it are out front spending a lot of money promoting it. But there's still a very real possibility it's going to fail because of that confusion we just mentioned.
Well, you're wading into the tax code, and I think anytime that happens, it's a pretty heavy lift for an awful lot of people. 5 days before the vote, what are you hearing?
That we were talking about this before the show, and the little bit of public opinion research that we've seen on it shows that the prospects for Proposal 1 are not promising, and this is largely anecdotal, but there does seem to be sort of a rising tide of skepticism about it, largely, based on just how complex and confusing it is. And a lot of people just seem to be looking at it and trying to, figure out where is the raw deal in this, that, businesses are spending literally millions of dollars on advertising right now, trying to convince people that that this is a good deal. And everyone's just sort of wondering, if this is such a good deal, why can't this be easily explained?
And the conventional wisdom seems to be that when voters are confused, they are more likely to vote.
That's not the conventional wisdom. That's a reality.
Okay. It's more than conventional wisdom.
Sure. One of the spokespeople promoting this issue is actually recommending to voters, if you don't understand it, maybe just take a pass on this one, which is an interesting suggestion.
Inspire a lot of confidence in their position.
Well, part of it too, might be that the legislature maybe got just a little bit too cute by half. That that when they passed the law to do this, the bill to do this, that instead of leaving it to state elections officials to craft, the language that would appear on the ballot, is that they did it themselves as part of the law and slipped in, these propaganda points that this is for small businesses, for example, just to name one. Their goal was to try and sort of put a nice sheen on a very complicated tax question, but maybe it just looked to some people like they were trying a little bit too hard.
Well, if you read the language, you pretty much have to be a tax accountant to understand it, which is not a good strategy when you have a proposal for the general public. The words personal property tax don't appear anywhere in the ballot question themselves.
We have elections professionals who, are practiced at boiling complex questions down to 150 words, but that wasn't good enough for the legislature.
I'm also struck by something that Jonathan alluded to a minute ago, and that is that there is a diverse group of interests that do support the proposal. I can't help but think that part of what's confusing voters here is, in a way, they've forgotten what to make of bipartisanism. If you can call that bipartisanism, it's a lot harder to form an opinion when there isn't the partisan divide that we've all grown accustomed to.
What there is not is organized opposition. You know, what we've been talking about is, you know, the unorganized, not disorganized, but unorganized skepticism. So you've got businesses, especially manufacturers, and of course that's a big deal in Lansing, who are for this because it's big money. They've been wanting to get rid of this personal property tax for decades. Mm-hmm. So they're and it's just been so complex. This is their moment. So they're for it. Local government officials are for it, despite the fact that you know they're somewhat skeptical of promises, you know, from Lansing, and that the legislature could go back and change this law if they wanted to, because this is the best deal that they could get, and they're really concerned about the alternative. If Proposal 1 goes down, the legislature is not going to give up on getting rid of the personal property tax, and what might happen then in a lame duck session of the legislature if this doesn't pass. And, you know, then you've got just a lot of other ancillary groups that are, you know, sort of tagged on because they have their own individual reasons. But almost all of them are on board, not because they love it, unlike the business groups, but because it's the least objectionable deal they could come up with.
Mm. We'll also point out that one of the higher profile opponents of Proposal 1, Warren Mayor Jim Fouts, mm-hmm. appears on Michigan Public TV's Off the Record. Just mm-hmm. in the event you're not confused enough already.
Even local officials are not unanimous in that this is a good deal. And the skepticism is primarily in that this is not an ironclad guarantee that local governments will continue to get that revenue. This is a statutory a mechanism to allow this to happen. And I think the estimates, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, that this would mean the diversion of about $500 million yes. from the state's general fund in about 10 years.
Sure.
So if 10 years from now, the legislature is looking at some budget troubles and saying, you know what, we think that we have a better idea on how to use $500 million than to keep sending it to local governments, they could change the law.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. We will move on here to a proposal to bring young Central American asylum seekers to Vassar, Michigan in Genesee County. That proposal led to some sharp dialogue and protests earlier this month. These would be 60 to 120 young refugees that are among the tens of thousands who have appeared at our southern border in recent months. Rick Pluta, remind us what this is all about.
Well, Wolverine Human Services operates a facility for at-risk youth up in Vassar. It's in the Thumb, and they got a contract from the federal government to take in some of these. They're unaccompanied minors, mostly teenagers. That they would come in, like you said, 60 to 120 kids, and they would be there for roughly a month before they were put into the immigration system and dealt with. And you know what's happened is just sort of this explosion of protest up in Vassar. There's actually, it's become an issue in a Republican state Senate primary in the area that the Republican challenger, who's a state representative, Kevin Daley, has asked for high priority legislation to cut state funding to Wolverine for doing this. And his opponent has said, why are we going to cut money for helping Michigan kids at this facility because you don't like what's happening with the Central American kids? But it's just become one more sharp point in the debate over immigration and what we do about these people who are actually coming over the borders. I mean, that is a reality, that these kids are coming, they're here, and something needs to be done while their final disposition is sorted out.
Vassar, as you said, Rick, is in the congressional district represented by Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee, who is on current state to discuss this. One of his key points was that the Central American asylum seekers should not be confused with the broader issue of immigration reform. Let's listen to his comments. Here he's referring to immigration reform here.
It's an important question. It's one that I wish that the Republican leadership in Congress would allow a full and complete debate on, so that we could get on with dealing with the immigration crisis. Our broken immigration system needs to be addressed. This situation is a case in point. But we can't allow, I don't think, a true humanitarian crisis to be conflated with the immigration question and then miss the opportunity and I think the obligation to protect children who are in danger.
Susan, any thoughts on those remarks? I mean, is he right to warn about conflating immigration reform on one hand with this situation?
Well, this is a unique situation. The reason why these children are coming over is the extreme violence in a lot of these Central American countries like Honduras. These children are coming from the murder capital of the world. And the reason why they've been able to stay here and go through the immigration system is because of some legislation that was passed during the George W. Bush administration that was meant to halt human trafficking and to help these children so they're not just sent back into these horrible conditions. And so while a lot of people don't want these children in Vassar, and there have been these very virulent protests, and people, you know, say just turn them away at the border, actually, with current law passed by Congress, that is not possible.
That's right. And the president, to be clear, the president has called for alterations to the Wilberforce Act in order to more efficiently deal with this situation. But that is the law right now. There were also several hostile encounters between opposing groups of protesters 2 weeks ago here in Lansing that were triggered by this. There was at least one arrest, a Lansing organization, Action of Greater Lansing. Also called on the Lansing City Council to agree, in principle at least, on a framework to let some of these Central Americans come to Lansing. Do we know where that stands?
I don't, but you know, Lansing does have a refugee relocation center, and you know, it has been doing this for a very, very, very long time from hotspots all over the world.
It's our month in review segment here on WKAR's Current State. Our guests, Rick Pluta from the Michigan Public Radio Network, Jonathan Osting of MLive, and Susan Demas of Inside Michigan Politics. Let's spend a minute on the campaign for governor, which is ongoing. Several times in just the last few days, Democrat Mark Schauer released plans. One, he says, would revitalize Michigan's economy. Susan, what was in there?
Well, it's this time of year where we see politicians' 10-point plans. Mark Schauer has, you know, a not very surprising plan. It's pretty much the Democratic Party platform as far as increasing renewable energy, increasing funding for education. And his goal is
don't forget the pension tax.
Right. Let's get rid of repeal the senior tax, pension tax, tax on retirement income, whatever phrasing you would like to use. And basically, he's kind of housing the all of these economic points in one blueprint. And he's saying that this is what's really going to turn around Michigan's economy. A central theme of his campaign has been that Governor Rick Snyder has not done enough, that his measures like right to work and his individual tax increases have not really had the effect that they were supposed to. So he's saying he's gotten a lot of criticism for, well, what's your plan? This is Mark Schauer's plan.
Sure.
Any response?
And it's not just Schauer's not just saying that Snyder hasn't done enough. He's also saying he's done the wrong thing. So he's talking about rolling back a lot of things that the governor has done beyond the pension tax, also restoring homestead property tax credits, earned income, and child credits on taxes. He's mentioned getting rid of the emergency manager law and replacing it with a modified transition scheme. I'm not exactly sure how it would work. But his plan,
and repealing
essentially,
right to work.
And repealing,
you know,
right
I mean,
to work, of course.
Which
sure.
His ability to do that is pretty questionable, but nevertheless, that it's something that you've got to bang the drum on.
And of course, fix the roads. But he didn't offer a highly specific plan for doing so. He said he opposes gas tax increase, which the governor and the state legislature have debated and not done. So he doesn't want to do that. One of his ideas is to get more money from Washington D.C.,
Every politician's idea sure. is to get more money from Washington, D.C. I'm going to get more money from my mom. It's interesting on road funding, though, that he was very, except for opposing a fuel tax increase, he was very nonspecific on where it would come from, just basically said that because of his background as a legislator, he would have the skills to bring people together. But it was a little bit reminiscent of where Rick Snyder was at the beginning, you know, way at the beginning of the gas tax debate. Remember that he came to the conclusion early on that putting a specific proposal on the table was probably a bad idea.
Well, when he did,
because the legislature will just pick it apart.
Right.
You know?
I mean, we saw in his State of the State for last year, he was very specific that he wanted to increase vehicle registration fees, you know, by an average of at least $100 per car.
He was also very specific that it was just an idea to talk about, you know,
but
well, maybe you come
becomes,
up with something.
It becomes more than an amorphous idea when you actually put
I'm
numbers to the plan,
and,
right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I think he learned his lesson, and I think that Mark Schauer saw that. And, you know, as much as we might, as journalists, may try and hold politicians accountable to be specific, it's usually not a bad thing to be vague.
If you're the politician.
Right.
How are the Schauer plans being received? Have they created any kind of response?
Well, environmentalists were really happy because he also resurrected the renewable energy mandates that, you know, which voters just rejected on the ballot. But, you know, the idea that if you increase the mandate on utilities to generate more electricity using renewable fuels, that there will be a commensurate boost to the Michigan economy because we will build here because we can build here wind turbines, solar panels. You know, we have the people, the infrastructure, the whatnot. So that is sort of this you know, government-led prescription to boost the economy.
Sure. In that case, we actually have a reversal where the governor is generally probably going to support some sort of new mandate, but said this isn't the year to do it in an election season. Mm-hmm. So he has not offered a specific plan.
Well,
Mark Schauer is offering with a plan, which was recommended by a Snyder administration commission. So.
His mantra has been flexibility.
Sure.
I just can't get over the flurry of plans. We had a 10-point jobs plan, a 5-point proposal to help women in the workplace, and charter school proposals. Mm. I want to say these were all released in under 5 days, 4 days, something like that. Is this a belated response to Republicans who have been saying Schauer doesn't have a plan?
Well, obviously, I think that the intention is to blunt that criticism. But I think it's also an attempt by Mark Schauer, who has not raised nearly as much money as the incumbent Rick Snyder, to get some earned media and to have us talk about him because he can't afford to be on the air with commercials right now.
A top Detroit development, the top Detroit development of July, had to be the response to ongoing water service shutoffs to people who either couldn't or wouldn't pay their bills. Rick, what was this about?
Wow, how much time do we have? you know, the Duggan administration, you know, came in that the mayor has control of the water department now. And the water department decided after many years of being lax about it that it was time to go after people who weren't paying their water bills for whatever reasons. Apparently, the average delinquent water bill in Detroit is about $500. And they succeeded in getting more people to either pay their water bills or get on a payment plan, but they also wound up cutting off a lot of people, and that sparked a lot of angst, a lot of protests, a lot of debate about whether or not the capacity to get water in a city is a human right. As a matter of fact, in some places there were even campaigns for people to like adopt a water customer. You know, if you're outraged by what's going on in Detroit, then you know, pick up the tab for you know, for someone. And the you know, water department officials said that you know, they really miscalculated the ferocity of the pushback on it, that people would be so angry about having their water shut off, and maybe if they had it all to do over again, that it would have been over a longer period of time, that they would have done more outreach to try and get people onto payment plans and things like that, you know.
Others disagree. I mean, other people insisted that this was primarily about getting people who can pay to pay, and apparently it is a longstanding practice in a lot of cities. It's an incentive to get scofflaws to pay up.
Oh, sure, and you know, it's always a controversy. I mean, we go through this you know, every winter, and you know, I mean, Michigan has reined in utilities' ability to shut off people's heat for non-payment in winter because there's just a similar controversy about that. That, you know, for whatever reasons, you know, there are just times when, you know, turning off the heat is unacceptable. And people are saying that, you know, when you live in the city of, when you live in a large city.
A bankrupt city. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know, simply taking away, you know, just simply cutting off low-income people's, you know, capacity to get water isn't the right thing to do.
Well, part of the controversy is that people have argued that this is more arbitrary, the, you know, who got shut off. Some of the bigger customers did not have their water shut off. Which
Businesses,
yeah. Specifically. And so there seemed to be one set of rules for individuals, one set of rules for businesses. This also coincided at a time of a liberal blogging convention in Detroit, Netroots Nation. And so this rose to prominence as more of a national issue. There was a big rally, and that kind of brought the issue to a fever pitch and resulted in this 15-day suspension.
Let's return briefly. We've got just a couple of minutes here. Let's return to next Tuesday. Which primary races are you watching most closely?
Well, I cover the state legislature primarily. I'm looking at a couple state House races that I think are really interesting. Some Tea Party candidates, Gary Glenn, Todd Corser, are each running in Midland and Lapeer, respectively. And they're up against what some might call the establishment. The DeVos family of West Michigan is spending a lot of money, and an education group they're associated with is running some really negative mailers against both of those Tea Party candidates, supporting more traditional Republicans for the race.
Talk to us about the 8th district, where we sit right now. Is this Mike Bishop's primary to lose and Eric Schertzing's primary to lose? What do you make of what's going on in the 8th?
Well, on Schertzing, basically he got thrown into the race late in the game because Democrats wanted to be prepared if an opportunity presented itself. They think that opportunity would come in the form of the nomination of Tom McMillan, who's, you know, much more of a Justin Amash type of Republican. You know, Mike Bishop has racked up the party endorsements. The incumbent Mike Rogers has endorsed him, you know, plus a lot of others. You know, as a factual matter, there really isn't a whole lot of daylight between, you know, Bishop and McMillan when it comes to policy. So, you know, really this is just about, you know, how they're going about characterizing each other and probably who would, you know, make a better legislator rather than, you know, where they stand philosophically. I will say one race I am it's not in this area, but up in Northwest Michigan is Frank Foster's re-election bid. That he's behind. He's the Republican who's been talked about as the possible sponsor to an amendment to add LGBT to the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. And a lot of the future of that, the balance of this session, depends on whether or not Foster survives his primary.
We have to leave it there. We want to thank our guests for our Month in Review segment, Rick Plute of the Michigan Public Radio Network, Jonathan Osting, thank you, from MLive, Susan Demas, thank you, from Inside Michigan Politics, and we're all waiting for Tuesday. Thanks very much.